Good morning. So good to see you today. We appreciate all of you being here. Several visiting. We thank you for coming our way today. In the last few years, there has been a proliferation of new kinds of churches. I'm not talking about just, you know, a new group starting somewhere, but a really kind of a whole different kind of group starting. Most of these have been kind of independent type groups rather than having some denominational affiliation. And they very often advertise that they feature some unique and maybe particularly attractive kinds of assemblies and worship. I remember one a few years ago that called itself Mac Church. And I think they patterned some things after the well-known hamburger chain. I'm not sure exactly what, but they called it Mac Church. There was another I read about several years ago where the preacher at this particular place absolutely assured that this was going to be a fast-paced experience, and he guaranteed he would have you in and out in 30 minutes. In fact, they held it in a gym with the shot clock going up there up front, so he made sure he was out. I don't know what happened if the buzzer went off, but anyway, he was going to get you out right on time. Just up the road here a little ways, across from the subdivision where we live, recently a man who lives there has started hosting what he calls Man Church. They put signs out for Man Church just every little bit. And I don't know what all they do. What they advertise is a manly meal and manly music and a manly message. And they draw a big crowd, whatever the night is. That they put the flags out there that they're having Man Church. It strikes me that what all of this is what I would call a kind of a church my way kind of a movement, where people want to devise church and some sort of worship and service to God, but with whatever appeals to me and whatever I want to do. And they would argue, no doubt, that these things are meaningful to them, and obviously they draw a crowd. But before we get a little too caught up in the Church My Way movement, I think we might ought to go back in our Bibles and review a little bit of history from our Old Testament about someone who essentially kind of did the same thing, a kind of a Church My Way program that he introduced. His name was Jeroboam, and we can read about him in 1 Kings, the 12th chapter. So I invite you to open your Bibles to 1 Kings chapter 12, and we'll read about Jeroboam and the new religion that he introduced and see what we can learn about this whole process. Jeroboam, if you recall from your history, this is after the time of the reign of King Solomon, when Israel really reached kind of its climax as far as a nation. But after Solomon's death, the nation divided. The tribes in the south followed Rehoboam, who was Solomon's son, and he reigned in Jerusalem. But the tribes in the north rebelled. The economic conditions and some other things under Solomon had just become oppressive, and from all appearances, they were going to be even worse under Rehoboam. And so these tribes rebelled and said they would have no more of that. And they appointed Jeroboam to be the king over them. So let's pick up the reading in 1 Kings chapter 12 and verse 25. The first thing the Bible says is that Jeroboam built Shechem in the hill country of Ephraim and lived there. And he went out from there and built Penuel. Now, Shechem was already in existence before this time. We can read about that earlier in our Bibles. So when it says that he built Shechem, evidently that means that he fortified it, grew the city, and probably built a royal residence there. He made that his new capital. And then he built Penuel, which was over on the other side of the river. Maybe that was an additional fortress, perhaps even a second kind of capital. Just don't know about all of that. But having done a few things like that to start to solidify his reign, the Bible then says, Jeroboam said in his heart, now the kingdom will return to the house of David. If this people go up to offer sacrifices in the house of the Lord at Jerusalem, then the heart of this people will return to their Lord, even to Rehoboam, the king of Judah. They will kill me and return to Rehoboam, king of Judah. So the king consulted and made two golden calves. And he said to them, "It is too much for you to go up to Jerusalem. Behold your gods, O Israel, that brought you up from the land of Egypt." The first thing that Jeroboam did in instituting a new kind of worship, if you will, is he changed the object of worship. He introduced to the people of Israel the idea of worshiping two golden calves. And he said, "These are the gods, Israel, who brought you out of Egypt." It seems rather unlikely that Jeroboam was actually pretending or trying to sell the idea that these golden objects which he had just formed, Israel should regard as gods who had historically been with them. That would have been quite a swing for the people to have bought into all of that. So it's more likely that Jeroboam was suggesting that somehow in these calves there was a kind of a representation of Jehovah, the God who had brought them from Egypt. But it may be more specific than that. Archaeological findings from that general time and area suggested that among some of the other cultures, it was common to have an animal, perhaps even especially a bull, who was depicted as kind of the foundation of the god, and the god rode on the back of this animal. And maybe that was the idea. God is an invisible god, you can't see him, but it is God who is on the back or the top of these bulls. You know, the people of Israel had already regarded God as the God who is enthroned above the cherubim. When God revealed himself to Israel and had them build that Ark of the Covenant with the two cherubim on top facing each other and with their wings spread out, he had said that he would dwell on the mercy seat atop that. And in 1 Samuel chapter 4 and verse 4, when they took that Ark into battle thinking that somehow that would bring God's blessing with it, they referred to it as God who dwells on top of the cherubim. So it wouldn't have been a real big reach for the idea of God who's on the cherubim to God who's on the bulls. Well, I don't know whether exactly the idea was that Jeroboam was trying to promote. I want you to emphasize with me something in the reading. Verse 26 says, Jeroboam said in his heart. Verse 28 says, the king consulted and made two golden calves. Whom did he consult with? Well, the text doesn't say, but I know whom he did not consult with. He did not consult with God, because God had been quite clear about this particular subject. Exodus chapter 20. To the sons of Israel, God spoke from heaven and said, "I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself an idol, or any likeness of what is in heaven above, or on earth beneath, or in the water under the earth. You shall not worship them or serve them. For I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children, on the third and fourth generations of those who hate me, but showing loving kindness to thousands, to those who love me and keep my commandments." And Jeroboam consulted God, he would have gotten a definitive answer about these golden calves. He evidently didn't consult history either. Because if he'd have consulted history, he'd have remembered this wasn't the first time that a golden calf was introduced as worship for the people of Israel. In fact, some think that he may have actually been trying to connect with what Aaron had done back there in Mount Sinai in Exodus chapter 32. When Aaron constructed the calf and said to the people of Israel that this was the God who had brought them out of Egypt. Well, if he was a poor student of history. Because on that occasion, God indicated His tremendous disdain for this new God or representation that Aaron had made. But here's the point. Jeroboam, when he wanted to change things up, began with a changed conception of God. And that's where it always has to begin. We always have to begin, if we're going to make it church my way, with an uninformed view of God. And I say that kindly, but if someone studies their Bible and understands the God of heaven, you would understand that some of the liberties that are being taken, He simply does not allow. But it starts with this view of God where somebody just says, well, I think God is so-and-so. And I think God views things this way. And it just seems to me like this would surely be acceptable to God. And we start with those kinds of premises, and that opens the door to all the rest. So what did Jeroboam do with these two objects of worship that he had made? Well, he also, in addition to a new object of worship, brought in a new place of worship. Going back to our text in 1 Kings chapter 12, the text says of Jeroboam that in verse 29, he set one in Bethel and the other he put in Dan. Now, God had already had something to say about the place of worship. Back in the book of Deuteronomy, when the children of Israel hadn't even come into the land of Canaan yet, God gave them some explicit instructions about their place of worship. Deuteronomy chapter 12 and verse 13. Be careful that you do not offer your burnt offerings in every cultic place you see, but in the place which the Lord chooses in one of your tribes, there you shall offer your burnt offerings, and there you shall do all that I command you. Early on, that place was Shiloh. And then later on, under David's reign, David took the city of Jerusalem. David brought the Ark of the Covenant there. Later, the temple was built there under King Solomon. And Solomon prayed with reference to that temple that God would accept this as the place of worship. And God responded in 2 Chronicles chapter 7 and verse 12. The Lord appeared to Solomon at night and said to him, I have heard your prayer and have chosen this place for myself as a house of sacrifice. So now the temple in Jerusalem is the place that God had chosen. And God had already said back in Deuteronomy 16 and verse 16 that three times a year all the males were to go to the place where God had chosen and they were to offer their sacrifices there. They were to come there and to observe festivals, feasts in honor of God. So God had been very specific about all that. But Jeroboam thought some other places would be better. And so with his kind of church my way mentality, he chose two other places, Bethel and Dan. And you know, when you think about it, Bethel seems like a pretty good choice. It'd make a lot of sense. Back in the book of Genesis, when we read about Abraham, the father of this nation that God had called, when Abraham came to the land of Palestine, one of the first places that he came was Bethel. And he built an altar there. Genesis 12 says he called on the Lord's name there at Bethel. A few years after that, his grandson Jacob was leaving home to go back to the family to find a wife back in Padan Aram. And Jacob in his travels stopped at a particular town one night just to spend the night. He lay down and he had a rock or stone for his pillow. And he had a dream that night. And in his dream he saw a ladder going up into heaven. And the angels were going up and down on this ladder. And when he awoke the next morning, he said, Surely God is in this place. He referred to this place even as the gate of heaven. The place was Bethel. That's where Jacob had that dream. And a few years later, actually 20 years or so later, after Jacob had spent a long time away from home and it was time for him to go back, God appeared to him in Genesis chapter 31 and verse 13, and he said, I am the God of Bethel. Well now, if Bethel, and the very name Bethel incidentally means house of God, Beth is the Hebrew word for house and El is the name for God, Bethel, house of God. If the very name means house of God, it's where the heavens were opened and the angels were going up and down to God. God identified Himself as the God of Bethel. Surely that would be a good place to have a place of worship, wouldn't it? Why, that would be a great choice. And so Jeroboam, thinking of a map, chose Bethel down in the south as one of the sites. He also chose Dan, which is all the way up in the north. Now, Dan also had a history as a worship site. Unfortunately, it was not as glorious of a history as Bethel was. You can read the last chapters of the book of Judges about the worship that took place at Dan. It was a little bit no more what we would call notorious than famous, but be that as it may. These are the two places that Jeroboam selected. And as you look at the map, you think, well, the first thing I notice about that is it looks like that it's marking out the southern and northern parts of his territory, which it was. And that may have had something to do with why he chose these sites. But he said to the people of Israel, it's too much for you to go up to Jerusalem. Behold your gods, O Israel, that brought you from the land of Egypt. He sold the idea of worshiping in Bethel and Dan versus going to Jerusalem. That's too burdensome to have to go all the way to Jerusalem. We need something closer to home, something more convenient. He's appealing to their sense of ease, to their sense of just making it the best for them. You know, the fact of the matter is that sometimes the things that Jehovah God requires of us aren't always the easiest thing to do. It's not always the cheapest. It's not always the shortest in terms of time. Sometimes it's just hard. But Jeroboam was selling the principle of convenience. And so he convinced the folks that Dan and Bethel would be the better choices. Now, I don't know whether this has occurred to you or not, but if you were looking at this map and you saw Bethel, you might look just a little bit to the south and there's Jerusalem. You know, the truth of the matter is it was only about 12 miles further to go on to Jerusalem than it was to go to Bethel. Now you think about that. Just 12 more miles and they could have done what the Lord said they ought to do. But Jeroboam convinced them that was too much. Bethel's close enough. So he changed the place of worship. He also changed the time of worship as well. Back in the book of Leviticus, when the Lord had given the instructions to Israel regarding their time of worship, I mentioned to you in Deuteronomy 16:16 that three times a year the males were to go to Jerusalem or whatever the place was that God put His name in. Those three times are identified. One of them was the Passover, which was in the first month on the 14th day. It was about a week-long feast that they celebrated. The second one was called sometimes the Feast of Weeks. Or in the New Testament, it's called Pentecost. And it was called the Feast of Weeks because it was approximately a week of weeks after the Passover. From the Passover, they were to count off 7 weeks, 7 sevens, and add one more. And then that would be the time of this next feast, Pentecost. And you can see that 50 element there in the Pente prefix. And then in the 7th month was the 3rd of these feasts. It was called the Feast of Tabernacles or the Feast of Booths. And it was to take place on the 7th month and 15th day of the month. The significance of that is also by virtue of the fact that on the 7th and the 10th, just 5 days earlier, was the annual Day of Atonement. And that was the climax of the calendar of religious service to God. That was the one day a year when the high priest could go into the most holy place. And that's when they offered the atonement to the people. Well, 5 days later came the 3rd feast. The Feast of Tabernacles was also in conjunction with the harvest. And sometimes it's called the Feast of Harvest. And it was a time, the end of the year, when they were bringing all the crops in. And so it was kind of a celebration of that as well. And that was what God had laid out. Jeroboam changed that. Verse 32 says, Jeroboam instituted a feast in the 8th month on the 15th day of the month, like the feast which is in Judah. And he went up to the altar. I'm not sure why he changed this, but he did. He decided the 7th month wasn't the best. He would make it the 8th. And I don't know what he named it. Text doesn't say what he named his feast either. I just wonder, though, if might possibly, anyway, this was another convenience factor. Could it be, just thinking out loud here, could it be that perhaps in the north where his people were, the crops came in just a little bit later? And they wouldn't be quite so rushed to get everything in and everything done by the 7th. They'd take one extra month and it would be better for them. I don't know whether that was the basis or not. But somehow he changed the time of worship as well. He's changed the object, he's changed the place, now he's changed the time. You know, God has said some things about the time of our worship as well. And there are some who don't seem to be particularly concerned about what God says about the time of our worship. There are some folks who think today that we're still supposed to be keeping the Sabbath. That was a part of the Old Testament law to the people of Israel. It was one of the 10 Commandments. But the Apostle Paul explained in the New Testament that the Sabbath was a part of the old. It was a shadow of the things to come. And so he wrote to the Colossians and he said, let no one act as your judge in regard to a Sabbath or new moon or those things, which are a mere shadow of what is to come, but the substance belongs to Christ. There are other folks that think that it doesn't matter what day. You just worship God any day. If Sunday's good for you, then Sunday's fine. But if Sunday's not good for you, well, we'll do it on Tuesday or we'll do it on Thursday or whatever. Man church seems to me like it's either Tuesday or Thursday. I'm not sure which, but it's one night when they have that. And people just pick whichever day it is. Now, in the first century, the disciples came together on the first day of the week to break bread. Acts 20 and verse 7. And when Paul instructed the Corinthians regarding the collection, he said every first day of the week, 1 Corinthians 16, verse 2, that was the day that they routinely worshipped. But some folks don't think it makes any difference. They think they can do as Jeremiah did and just change that up too. Make it however suits up. Jeroboam changed something else too. He changed the altar. He changed the place. Not only in terms of geography, where the worship, but he changed the way in which it would be done by bringing about a new altar. Once again, God had given a lot of specifics about His altar. You can read about those in the book of Exodus in chapter 27 when the instructions are given, or in chapter 38 when the actual altar was built. It was made out of wood, acacia wood. It was about 5 cubits by 5 cubits by 3 cubits tall. It had a bronze grid on it on which the animals were put when they offered the sacrifices. That was the original altar. when Solomon built the temple in Jerusalem, they redid the altar and it was much, much bigger than that. 2 Chronicles chapter 4 and verse 1 says that the altar that was built for the temple was 10 by 10. Actually, it was 20 by 20 cubits and 10 tall. It was a huge altar compared to that old original one. But it was the altar that God had given. And I want you to notice something that Jesus said about that altar, about the significance of it. This is in the Gospel of Matthew when Jesus made a comment about that. Jesus was actually talking about the practice of the people in His day regarding taking oaths. A lot of them had the idea that whether you were bound to keep your word or not depended on what you swore by. If you swore by the temple versus gold in the temple, it might make a difference. Or, Matthew chapter 23 and verse 18, He said that they were saying, whoever swears by the altar, that is nothing, but whoever swears by the offering on the altar, he's obligated. And here's what Jesus said about that. You blind men, which is more important? The offering or the altar that sanctifies the offering? Did you catch what Jesus said there? It's the altar that sanctifies the offering. The offering in and of itself is not necessarily acceptable to God unless it is offered to God in the way that God said. And that requires doing it on His altar. It is His altar that sanctifies the offering. Jesus said it would make a difference. To Jeroboam, it made no difference, though. I don't know what his looked like. The Bible doesn't give any description of what Jeroboam's altar looked like. But read with me verses 32 and 33 of our text. And I want to emphasize something with you as we do. It says, Jeremiah instituted the feast in the 8th month, on the 15th day of the month, like the feast which is in Judah, and he went up to the altar. Thus he did in Bethel, sacrificing to the calves which he had made. And he stationed in Bethel the priests of the high places which he had made. Then he went up to the altar which he had made in Bethel. On the 15th day in the 8th month, even in the month which he had devised in his own heart. You see the emphasis in there? Which he had made, which he had devised in his own heart. The historian is emphasizing to us that Jeroboam is changing things from the instructions that God gave. One more change that Jeroboam made. He made a change in the priesthood as well. God had said to Moses, back in the book of Exodus, chapter 28 and verse 1, separate for me Aaron and his sons as priests to me. And so if you wanted to be a priest under the Old Testament system, you had to be a descendant of Aaron. That is what God specified. Aaron was from the tribe of Levi, but not every Levite could be a priest. You had to be in the family of Aaron. I take it from the way this is worded in 1 Kings chapter 12 that Jeroboam himself acted as priest. In the last part of verse 33, it says, he instituted a feast for the sons of Israel and went up to the altar to burn incense. Jeroboam wasn't from the tribe of Judah. He wasn't from the family of Aaron. He was from the tribe of Ephraim. Wrong tribe. But he wasn't the only priest in his priesthood. Over in chapter 13, in verse 33 of 1 Kings, it says, after this event, Jeroboam did not return from his evil way, but again he made priests of the high places from among all the people. Any who would, he ordained to be priests of the high places. You want to be a priest? Jeroboam says, fine, you can be a priest in my service. We're open to everybody. And You could see how he would sell that to the crowd. So Jeroboam changed just about everything there was with reference to the worship. He changed the object of worship. He changed the place. He changed the way in which it was done. He changed the time at which it was done. He even changed the priesthood. Now, the New Testament says that all Christians are priests. Peter refers to us that way in 1 Peter chapter 2, that we are, in fact, he says we are a royal priesthood. He says we're a holy priesthood, back in verse 6. Revelation chapter 1 describes us as a kingdom of priests. We don't need some special priest to validate our worship or through whom we can offer. At the same time, the New Testament does put some restrictions on whom God will allow to lead in public worship. In 1 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 8, for example, it has to be men lifting up holy hands. In the verses that follow, there is a prohibition against the women teaching or exercising authority over the men in that context. That wouldn't have mattered too much to Jeroboam, I don't think. The church my way crowd just kind of opens things up and makes them however we would have them to be. Now, we close with two questions. What did God think about Jeroboam's new religion? What was God's view of the church my way in his day? I didn't read one of the verses. I didn't read verse 30 of our text. It says, "Now this thing became a sin, for the people went to worship before the one as far as Dan." If you read chapter 13, you can do that this afternoon sometime, but if you read chapter 13, you'll also get a view of what God thought about it. But I think one of the best views of it is a statement over in 2 Kings chapter 17. 2 Kings 17, verse 21. Speaking of God, it said, "When he had torn Israel from the house of David, they made Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, king. Then Jeroboam drove Israel away from following the Lord and made them commit a great sin. The sons of Israel walked in all the sins of Jeroboam which he did. They did not depart from them until the Lord removed Israel from his sight as he spoke through all his servants, the prophets. So Israel was carried away into exile from their own land to Assyria until this day." That calls it a sin. That text calls it a great sin. It was a sin so grievous that the people never turned away from it. And when God had had enough of all of that, he took the people away from the land. That's what God thought of Jeroboam's new religion. Now the practical question. What would God think today of people who take liberties with his instruction about how we are to worship and approach Him, and set those aside in view of what their own preferences might be? Hebrews chapter 2 says, "For this reason we must pay much closer attention to what we've heard, so that we do not drift away from it. For if the word spoken through angels proved unalterable, and every transgression and disobedience received a just penalty, how shall we escape if we neglect so great a salvation?" In verse 2, when he refers to the word spoken through angels, he's talking about God's Old Testament instructions. And he's saying, if God reacted so strongly in the Old Testament to people who set aside his instructions, how much more had we better pay attention to the fuller revelation that God has given us? I think that answers our question. Let's respect God and His will and His instructions for us. And let's make sure whether we're talking about in our formal worship to Him or in the way we live on a day-to-day basis, how we conduct our relationships, whatever it is, let's make sure that we're doing it not our way, but we're living God's way. Are you living God's way? Are you a disciple of Jesus Christ? That is God's will for you, to become a disciple of Jesus Christ. That's not just becoming a church member. That's living every day in service to the Lord who died for you so that you can have life. Will you come confessing your faith in Jesus? Will you turn from wrong? Will you let Him be the Lord of your life and determine to live for Him? And express that by, in the beginning point, of being baptized into Him for the forgiveness of your sins. If you're ready to do that, come on down to the front as we stand together and sing.